This is Software Engineering Radio, the podcast for professional developers on the web at se-radio.net. SE Radio is brought to you by the IEEE Computer Society and by IEEE Software Magazine, online at computer.org/software.
For Software Engineering Radio, this is Robert Blumen. I have with me Ganesh Datta, co-founder and CTO of Cortex.io. Prior to that, he was principal software engineer at Mission Lane. Ganesh is a graduate in computer science of UC San Diego, and he's the creator of the Python Etherpad client library. He previously appeared on Software Engineering Radio, episode 544, to discuss DevOps versus SRE. Ganesh, welcome back to Software Engineering Radio.
Great to be back.
Today, we're going to be talking about production readiness. Let's start out with, what is production readiness?
Yeah, at its core, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's given a piece of software, a deployable asset of some sort, is it ready to be in the critical path to production? Meaning, can it take traffic? Can it be monitored? Can it be managed in production? If there are incidents, are you able to resolve those in a meaningful way? Is it secure? Is it ready for prime time? That is kind of the essence of production readiness. And it can be different from organization to organization, depending what your requirements are and what you consider to be production ready. But at its core, it's the question of, is this ready for prime time? Is this service software ready for prime time?
I'm sure that all organizations have always had some notion of those things, but the term production readiness as a really self-conscious, coherent entity has some history. How did we get to where it became a thing?
I think production readiness became as big as it is now in the zeitgeist with the introduction of microservices. You know, if you think about kind of the macro trend, microservices were really introduced to create autonomy for engineering organizations, right? If you have many teams in an organization, how do you give each of those teams autonomy to move quickly, to deploy on their own, and ship extremely fast? And the outcome of that was you have a lot of teams that are autonomous and are making decisions on their own. And when it comes to operational excellence, now all of a sudden you have teams that are doing things in very different ways. And so as an organization, how do you drive consistency around, if something goes down, we are able to operate and resolve this incident very quickly, or we have consistent standards across the organization around what good looks like for something to be in production, because every team might have a different definition of that. And so how do we drive consistency around that? So I think that's where we've seen kind of a resurgence of this conversation around production readiness. Is we're kind of moving away. This kind of a macro trend with microservices as a whole is we started with just pure autonomy, and now we're thinking about autonomy with guardrails. How do we let teams keep moving autonomously, but put guardrails in place so that we can operate with excellence as a large engineering organization? And production readiness is one pillar of that journey.
I understood your last point. If you had a monolith, then you would have a process for deciding when to release or not. But with monolith, you did not have the issue of how do we ensure that everybody's doing things the same way. You only have that when you split things into more than one piece. Was that your point?
Yeah, I think that's it's mostly true. I think it with monoliths, you still kind of had the issue around, it was more like feature production readiness. Like given a thing, I am merging into the monolith, like does this new feature or capability I'm adding meet our production standards around, does it have proper logging, auditability? It was kind of more like the micro level of like this particular thing I'm shipping, does it do the things I expect? But with microservices, it's become more of this like big picture, you know, we need to apply these standards across every single piece of software in the organization, which I think is just like a different question of scale. It's like the macro versus micro lens of production readiness.
So when we're talking about production readiness, is it a process, a set of checklists, a meeting you have? What is it?
That is a great question. I think the thing that we are trying to get people to see is it should be a combination of all of the above. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about current state and ideal state with production readiness. Today, most organizations treat production readiness as a checklist, or a meeting, or a process. It's one of those three things. And generally that looks like a Confluence page where, you know, your SRE team is going in and defining a set of standards and says, hey, before you go to production, you must abide by these things. And if you don't, like, you're not going to go to production. And then maybe you have a meeting where you go through those things and company comes in and says, look at my service, I am production ready. And then you got to production and that's kind of where it ends. And I think what we're seeing is, like, that is the fallacy of production readiness, is it needs to be not just a process, not just a checklist, but kind of a continuous process. Just because something goes to production and it's meeting those standards today doesn't mean it's meeting those standards 6 months from now. Things could have materially changed in your production lifecycle. And so how do you kind of go back and say, like, is this thing still ready for production? Like, should this thing even be in production if I were to reassess it today? And you can't do that in a meeting. You can't do that with a checklist. And so how do we kind of rethink what is a production readiness process that we should be going through? So that's kind of how we're thinking about the general problem of production readiness.
I want to deep dive into all those things. But before we do that, I have a couple other questions. Production ready is primarily for shipping a new product, or would this be at the granularity of smaller, like a feature or a PR or a bug fix? What's the granularity of this production readiness?
I would say generally not PRs in isolation. If you think about your classic kind of feature that you're delivering or some change you're making in a PR, your automated unit tests, your integration tests are probably enough from like a readiness perspective. I would say in very mature organizations or enterprise organizations with high standards for excellence, you're probably thinking about production readiness, at least at the feature level, where given a new feature you're releasing, you know, the standards might be different from like a product level from a feature level. At the feature level, you're probably thinking about, does this thing have the right audit logs? Does it have the right RBAC enforcement within our product? Does it have the right telemetry? Does it have product metrics? Like, things like that, you're kind of thinking about more holistically from individual feature level. And so, like, most very mature organizations are doing it at the feature level. Most organizations are still at the kind of service deployable artifact level, which is, can this entire piece of software be in production? And they're not really thinking about individual features because it requires like another level of maturity. And if your process is very onerous, it takes a lot of effort even just to do that at the service level. You're probably not going to do it at the feature level because it's way too much overhead.
Well, we're talking about the origin, what it all means, and the history. I have to ask about Google's impact on this. Google has been very influential through a number of books and best practices in defining the industry conversation around this and introducing the term SRE. To what extent did this concept of production readiness originate with the Google SRE model?
It played a very, very big role, for sure. And the way it did that is because literally the introduction of the SRE role meant that organizations were kind of handing off first line defense to the SRE function, saying if something goes down, site reliability engineers own the first line of reliability, and they own kind of that general concept across the organization. And so SRE said, like, hey, we can't be on call and dealing with fires if we don't know how to operate your service. And so therefore, for us to be able to reliably operate your service, before you hand your service off to us as first line defense, you must follow these set of standards. And so you'll see it starts to sound very much like the production readiness we're talking about. In a lot of organizations, they call this, you know, the SRE readiness playbook. Is this service ready to be handed off to the SRE organization? Which is, again, do you have the right telemetry, do you have the right logging, do you have the right run books? Like, is this thing something that an SRE who maybe has no, you know, context as to the actual functionality of that service can still operate that service because it is mature from an operational perspective? And so now, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, you build it, you own it, or an SRE model, or whatever kind of operational model you have. I think that idea of, like, this thing is ready to be operational has now translated into this broader production readiness topic. And so, yeah, the SRE guidebooks and concept coming from Google definitely had a massive impact on the current thinking around production readiness.
I have a note here, which I may have copied verbatim, or maybe this is my own words, in which they define production readiness as the process of onboarding onto SRE support, which sounds to me like a summary of what you just said. Would you want to differ with any aspect of that?
I would completely agree. I think the only thing I would add to that is when you have, like, SRE readiness is very much from the lens of, as a person with no context about this service, can I reasonably operate it? Which makes a ton of sense. I think current modern production readiness has a few additional things that have been added to it which are reflective of the more holistic version of production readiness that we practice today at most organizations, which involves not just like SRE operational aspects, but also things like security aspects. So, you know, does this particular service you're trying to deploy have any outstanding vulnerabilities? You know, are you managing vulnerabilities in a reasonable format? Do you have disaster recovery? Do you have, you might even include things like code quality metrics. You know, is this, assuming SRE finds an issue and they can't resolve it and it gets passed on to the actual owner of that service, can that owner of the service actually remediate this issue in production? Or is the code too complicated? Or is there a high likelihood of there being an issue because you haven't followed the right testing practices? And so production readiness has kind of like grown into the process of onboarding onto SRE plus kind of the additional holistic aspects of like, is this thing production ready from a security platform quality perspective as well? So it kind of a superset of production readiness as defined by Google, I would say.
I don't recall the date when the SRE book was published by Google. It may have been around 10 years ago. What you're saying is they really started the conversation and then it has evolved in a certain direction since that time.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm curious about, do you have any stories from your career of being part of an organization that adopted production readiness? What were they trying to get out of it and how did it go?
Yeah, actually I have a personal anecdote. So at Mission Lane and previously LendUp, I had the opportunity to drive some of those production readiness standards across the organization. And maybe I'll kind of give you a before and after, like what even prompted us to start thinking about production readiness and what was the kind of outcome of driving those standards. So before we kind of started driving these production readiness standards, we had been going through this monolith to micro macro service, you know, journey for 2.5 years or so. And what we found is initially when we pulled microservices out of the monolith, it was, there weren't that many. It was fairly simple to monitor. They looked very much like the like the monolith itself. Over time, we invested in tooling and infrastructure to make it really easy for people to spin up services, which was the goal, and it succeeded, and people started breaking things out of the monolith. And because of the size of the organization, it was about 100 engineers or so, and we're moving so quickly. There were still a lot of dependencies between services and teams and things like that. And so when you got alerted in the middle of the night, you know, it's 2 a.m., something goes off, and you would pull up a service, and you're like, oh, my service is, you know, running into issues from something downstream. Let me, you know, go look at the logs for that service and see if I can determine something because I have some context. It's not, we're not so massive that I have to escalate and page that team immediately. But then you would look at that service and you have no idea where the dashboards are. You have no idea, you know, the logs are a completely different format from your service. And like the operational overhead of trying to triage this 2 a.m. when something's wrong was so massive. And that was kind of the initial prompt for production readiness is, hey, if we standardize the way we do things from a operational health, monitoring, alerting, telemetry perspective, then when somebody's on call, something goes wrong, it'll be way easier for us to figure these things out because there's a lot of familiarity, there's consistency, and that will make it easier when things hit the fan. And so we put together these set of standards like, hey, what do we really care about? You know, we care about logging format, we care about request tracing so that we can trace a request across multiple services, we care about standard formats for your dashboards, and they are easily discoverable. They're well documented somewhere. You have a clear escalation path. So if something goes wrong and I can't figure out what's going on, I know who to escalate this thing to. There is a standard set of metrics that you're emitting, you know, things like HTTP response throughput, status codes. You know, if you're making additional calls to external systems, are you doing kind of like pre and post request logging? You know, basic things that are like, hey, if we all do these things together, then it's going to make it really easy to manage incidents. And so we started enforcing this and we created a spreadsheet and we said, okay, these are all the requirements. We're going to go service by service and we're going to evaluate them against these requirements. Found gaps, we resolved those gaps, and it had a massive impact on not just like our MTTR, but even the quality of life for developers. Because now it's like, hey, I'm on call. I don't feel like I'm being thrown to the wolves. And it's the Wild West where when I'm alerted, I know exactly that this information is available to me. And at the very least, I can triage the incident and route it to the right person from there on. And so we saw a massive impact in that MTTR and developer quality of life. And so that was kind of like the evidence that we needed that this production readiness process was super impactful. It kind of just created more cohesion in the way we were shipping things. Even though teams could, you know, build in different ways, at the end of it, the thing that they were building kind of looked and felt the same from an operations perspective, which was massive.
That's great. Maybe you could define MTTR. And is that the number one metric you would look at for evaluating success of a production readiness adoption, or are there others?
I would say there's two aspects. So MTTR is mean time to resolution or mean time to recovery, depending how you define it. It's basically how quickly can you get out of an incident, put very simply. And you know, the quicker you're able to find information, the more consistent things are, the more visibility there is, the likelier you are to be able to resolve an incident faster. And if you're following a certain set of standards, you know, this is kind of going back to the idea of broader, more holistic production readiness. Like if you're doing automated unit testing and all these things, you're probably not going to have those incidents in the first place. And so generally this concept of like, can we reduce the number of incidents, and or if an incident occurs, can we reduce the amount of time it takes to resolve that incident, are kind of the two big picture items. But the third one I will add, and we're seeing this a lot more these days, is the developer experience around incidents. And that's kind of what I was alluding to a little bit there, which is the developer sentiment or happiness or experience around when an incident occurs. Do I feel like I'm in control? Like, incidents are stressful. There's lots of unknown variables. Things are kind of all over the place. But within that chaos, does the actual kind of processing information, do you feel like you have what you need to at least start digging into it? Or are you like, oh my God, this is a black box. I have no idea where to start. It's like, there's no information for me. So that sentiment, and we're starting to see sentiment also be captured in like this transition from DORA to space metrics, which is, you know, DORA with additional sentiment and developer experience and happiness layered on top of that. I would say for production readiness, sentiment is also a big part of that, because it's like, how do developers feel when they're on call, given that it's such a high stress moment for people when they get alerted.
Great. Let's delve into now the big three: checklists, meeting, and process. I'll let you decide where do you want to start, then we'll drill down a bit into those one at a time.
Yeah, maybe we can start with the process. And I think that will naturally segue into the checklist, because there's a lot of overlap there.
Great. Production readiness is a process. How would you characterize it?
In most organizations, painful and not always followed. And so to expand on that a little bit further, I would say it's not followed very frequently because it is painful. It is painful because it's manual, and it's manual because it's usually a manual checklist. And so you can kind of see where those things start to go a little hand in hand. Generally, the process that we see at most organizations today is there's a Confluence page or some sort of Jira checklist type thing where I need to attest and validate that I've done a certain set of things that proves that my service is production ready. I go through this, I fill it out myself, and then I bring this to a committee, or I submit this for approval to whoever the powers that be are that verify production readiness. In some cases, that doesn't exist. It's just me filling it out for evidence and me approving it, saying, hey, yep, I'm production ready. If you have an SRE process, it's usually SRE who says, yep, this looks good, or no, you haven't done these things, go back, do these things. And it's a kind of iterative process there. And then throughout this process, the powers that be or SRE, whoever, are kind of reviewing this. They're looking at your service and they say, cool, you are now green, you're approved to production. And then I go to prod. And that's the end of the production readiness process. It's never followed again. I never come back to it. That service has been given a lifetime stamp of approval for production readiness after following this very manual checklist. So that is the current state in most organizations of production readiness.
Is this a very cut and dried thing where I'm going through the checklist, and we'll go into what's on the checklist, but let's say one of the items is logging. So I say, yes, I have logging. No, I don't have alerting, and so on. Or is there a lot more discussion about between the people who are involved in this meeting of, do you really have an adequate amount of logging based on the product you're trying to launch? Have you really done an adequate amount of planning? Is it more of you need to convince SRE that you've thought of everything to, you know, sufficient amount of depth?
It's a great question. There's definitely levels to it. I think we definitely see a lot of organizations where production readiness is literally, do you have logging? Do you have monitoring? Do you have an on-call rotation? Cool. That's all we have the time to approve right now. Okay, we don't have capacity. From there, it kind of goes a little bit further, which is more of a discussion like, are you following our standard logging format? Are you doing request tracing? And do you have span IDs in all of your logs so that we know we can trace within a single request as well? Do you not only have monitors, but do you have specific types of monitors that we know are important, whether it's very basic things like CPU and memory and throughput and things like that, but that you also have, you know, monitors and alerts for things that are relevant to the business functionality of the service. SLOs are a great example of this, where you probably need to have some standard set of SLOs, like what is your uptime, latency, but then do you have, again, business level SLOs that you're holding the service accountable to? And then from there, it gets even more advanced. You know, in the largest of enterprises, we see things like disaster recovery, multi-region, backups, you know, like have you done load testing and performance testing? Do you know the spike capacity of this particular service and how much traffic can it handle? And all those things need to be evidenced and security needs to do a review. And so there's a wide spectrum of production readiness depth and processes that we've seen. And some of it is very much just like a stamp, and some of it's very much like a, hey, talk us through your disaster recovery. What does it look like? How are you going to apply it? Is this the right set of metrics? Are these too noisy? So yeah, there's definitely a spectrum of it that we see across the board.
If I was doing a review of that type and I was given a question, do you have a multi-region? Yes, no. And my answer is, no, I don't. Did we need that? I hope that some of these things, which would have a major architectural impact, would drive the entire product development lifecycle so that by the time you get to this process, hopefully everything can be checked.
It is a valid thought. I think this is where we're seeing more collaboration between SRE and platform teams these days, because, you know, when we're talking about autonomy before, autonomy meant that as a software developer, I can just go out and create my repo and bootstrap some code and spin up an RDS instance somewhere and say like, all right, I got my service. I did my job and we're good to go. And then SRE is like, whoa, oh my God, like what is this? And, you know, what we're seeing now is like platform teams are being reached out to by SRE teams and saying, hey, as an SRE team, these are the things that we're enforcing. Platform teams, can you help us create a golden path for developers so that if they want to create an RDS instance, there's like a one-click button or some sort of workflow they can go through that's going to give them the database that they so desire that is already following all of our SRE principles from day one, so we don't have to go through this checklist anymore. So we're seeing this partnership between the cloud platform infra teams and SRE teams who are trying to now give developers a tool to say, if you follow our golden paths, you're basically good to go. We have codified all of our standards into these starter kits so that you are good from day one, so we don't have to think about these things. So that's kind of the next iteration that we're seeing of software practices when it comes to production readiness as well. That's a great call out.
I'm going to link to the show notes. We have an episode in our archives about platform engineering. I don't recall the number at this time, but we'll be in the show notes. Have you ever seen a situation where there's pressure to sweep issues under the rug and agree that a production readiness has passed just to meet deadlines or product launches when the service wasn't really as ready as it should have been?
I wouldn't be surprised if it happens, though I think it's more of a visibility and or manual checking downfall, if I will. Like, I think if there are deadlines to pass, you probably can't go as deep into the analysis of certain areas as you might otherwise. And so I don't think, because, you know, the production readiness is directly impacting the developer's experience. I mentioned like SRE is now on the hook for the uptime of that service and developers are going to get paged. I think there's generally an intent to say, hey, we're not going to, you know, skimp on these steps, but you probably are not able to go as deep into those checklists and say like, hey, are we just following the letter of the law or the spirit of the law? And I think that's where things tend to fall apart more.
I have a quote from the Grafana Labs production readiness review. They've been very kind to open source their production readiness process to the community. The author who's listed in the show notes, he said, we sometimes found it useful to have the reviewer assume the role of an attacker who tries to break the system in review. Any issues we identify are filed as product bugs. Is that a good practice? What's your view on that?
That is a great practice. And we see this even in product development a little bit. And this is an interesting topic because something I've been thinking a lot about is kind of the transformation of some of these roles like SRE and platform into more product-minded individuals. Like, hey, are we delivering the experience to our customers, whether internal or external, that we care about? And so they're trying to take on this product mindset. And the reason I say that is because in product organizations, you see this concept of a pre-mortem a lot. And we're seeing this in engineering organizations as well a lot more frequently, but it's the same idea of like, how could this thing fail? Like, I'm going to spend time pretending like I'm doing a post-mortem and say, this is how it failed. And if we can do that upfront, then we figured out the way it would fail and we can assess the service against that. So I think it's a great practice because it forces you to think about the failure modes. And I think this is, even as a founder, something we do a lot at the business level. It's like, hey, what are the ways that the business could fail? And well, if we know the answer to that, we can work backwards and fix those problems before they actually occur. And so production readiness is no different. Like, you should definitely think about it from a perspective of what could fail here? What are the failure modes for the service that could cause outages and downtime? And that's your backlog right there. So I really love that concept.
Can you give an example of a pre-mortem or production readiness review you're involved in that surfaced an error mode that had not been known?
Yeah, so we actually, you know, went through this exercise internally for a feature a couple of years ago, which was our scorecarding product. And I won't go into too much of the details of what scorecards do right now, but you know, one of the things that scorecards rely on are third-party integrations. So we talk to a lot of third-party tools, and you probably can kind of see where we're going with this. At scale, you're probably going to run into a lot of rate limits from third-party integrations. And so we talked about that in the pre-mortem, and we said, hey, this is going to do two things. One, it could potentially cause a whole bunch of noise for us as operators of that scorecarding service. But B, it could also create outsized customer impact because they see a bunch of 429s as a kind of pass-through from third-party integrations that we're pulling data from, and then that's going to result in a bunch of support tickets and that functionally some sort of an incident. And so we said, okay, well, handling rate limits at scale is quite a hard problem to do, and we've since solved that problem. But we were able to kind of put the lens of, okay, how do we solve the most pressing issues here? Well, one, we need to be able to gracefully handle these exceptions and 429 errors from third-party integrations and surface that to ourselves in meaningful reports so that we're not getting alerted on it, but we still have visibility into it. And then B, we need to rethink the product experience in those cases, like what happens if a third-party integration rate limits us and how is that brought to the consumer? So it actually was kind of twofold from a sense of, as the owner of the service that's going to get paid for this thing, how do I make sure that I have the visibility without getting alerted for it? But then also the product question that it then brought up as a result of thinking about the technical complexity and the technical failure modes. And so we were able to kind of create a better user experience as a result of that, both internally and externally.
The process you outlined, it involved a checklist and a review meeting. Now would be a good time to talk about the checklist. I made up a list of about 20 things that I saw in different checklists. We might not have time to go through 20 things, but what are some of the more important things that are on this checklist?
Yeah, I think, let me talk about kind of the current state that we're seeing, or like the aspirational state of production readiness that we're seeing for folks. I think it starts with the very basics, which is there an accountable owner for the service so that if something goes wrong, we know who to escalate this thing to? Is there an attached on-call rotation that alerts are routed to? Are we doing automated unit testing? So we're still kind of like not even thinking about true production readiness, but it's more of like the holistic picture. So is there automated unit testing? Is there a up-to-date deploy pipeline and CI/CD pipeline? These are kind of like your just simple basic. If you don't do any of this stuff, like let's not even have a conversation about production readiness because you're in a different world altogether. Then from there, we kind of see like the next level of items on the checklist, which is monitoring, logging, telemetry, observability related. So do you have the right set of monitors? A, are you emitting metrics to our observability tool of choice? Do you have the right set of monitors and alerts? Do you have alerts routing to the right on-call rotation? Do you have the monitors and alerts that we believe are useful for this organization? Do you have SLOs defined for this particular service? Do you have runbooks in place so that in the well-known failure modes, you can easily recover from those? Do you have a well-documented deploy pipeline? Do you have your dashboards in a easily discoverable place so that people are not scrambling to try and find the dashboard when things actually go wrong? And then we get into even more advanced things in those checklists, which are around security. So things like vulnerability management, you know, have you resolved all critical vulnerabilities? And do you have a process in place to manage those vulnerabilities? You know, things that sound dumb, but are not so dumb, like do the people in your on-call rotation actually have their notifications enabled so that if something goes wrong, they will actually get paged and it's not just going to go to do not disturb and get silenced in the middle of the night? You know, do you have disaster recovery processes? Are your multi-region, are multi-region backups? Do you have graceful failover modes? You know, things like that are kind of general themes of things that we see in production readiness checklists.
You managed to hit a lot of the items on my list. Another one that I have, you didn't mention, was capacity planning.
Yeah, that one is interesting because we see that be more kind of like a conditional production checklist item. So for example, if this is a tier three service that's not in the critical path, you know, you probably want to do some sort of capacity planning, but there's some same defaults that's going to get you pretty far. But depending on the criticality of this service, which by the way, in more mature organizations is a part of the production readiness process, is have we determined the criticality of the service from a business impact perspective? And then based off of that determination, you know, do we need to do load testing and capacity planning for this? Do we have auto scaling enabled? All those kinds of things become a part of the process. And so, you know, part of this checklist can be conditional based off of the service and the blast radius and the impact of that service in question as well.
We're talking mostly about ensuring you have enough capacity. Another item that I found on some of these checklists are resource caps and spend limits to ensure it doesn't go rogue and go over budget.
Yes, we are seeing a lot more of that. That's a great call out, especially with Kubernetes and things like that. It's become a lot easier to enforce those. Though we are seeing in some cases, people are trying to catch that in the actual pipeline or process itself. So, you know, using OPA, Open Policy Agent, or things like that to enforce that at the Kubernetes definition layer itself versus even having that be an open question during the production process. Which is something probably worth chatting about is, you know, the actual process of filling out this checklist, you know, automated or manual, is a whole other discussion in and of itself. So yeah, we're definitely seeing kind of cost caps and things like that be a part of the process, though generally trying to automate those things as well.
There are regulatory compliance standards that many organizations adhere to, such as GDPR and SOC. They sometimes require you to have certain processes in place, such as incident response, postmortems. Are there other processes that the team has to have? You mentioned that you need to have on-call rotation, but what about some of these other processes?
Yeah, I would say mature organizations or organizations that are audited or have high compliance requirements tend to have kind of a two-phase review process. So production readiness is generally going to be the most micro-level version of those compliance things that you can possibly enforce. And so you can kind of think of it as like unit testing versus integration testing. Like production readiness is almost like the unit testing aspect, which is, do you have on-call rotation? Do you have monitoring? Do you have alerting? And kind of these, like, if you don't have these things, there's no way you're going to even meet our SOC 2 requirements. So we're not even going to bother, you know, passing you if you don't have those basic requirements. And then you have a separate kind of compliance process around, okay, are you actually using those things in order to maintain an incident management process and things like that. So production readiness, the way we think about it is more of like I mentioned, the unit testing of, do you have the micro components that are required in order to then operate the service? And then your compliance requirements are more, are you using those things in the right way? Are you actually following the process that those production readiness standards then enable you to do so? It's kind of how we've seen it break out in most organizations.
Another item I found when looking at some of these online was dependencies on other services. I could see that going in a lot of directions, including, do we now need to do another review of those services to ensure they can handle increased load from having more clients calling them? What are the implications of that?
Yeah, so this is actually a good question because it brings up the question of programmatic or continuous monitoring of production readiness, because this is a great example of one of those things that can change magically and other service owners have no idea something changed that impacts the production readiness requirements for their services. And so starting with, you know, if I'm the service owner of a service that is making calls on something else, I have to consider from a production readiness standpoint, you know, security concerns, authorization, things like, you know, runbook automation, like do I have visibility into my downstream services and the owners of those services? So put differently, if I am introducing a dependency on a service that is not production ready, or is not currently meeting the production readiness requirements, it will be very difficult for me in real life to maintain high production readiness caliber for my own service, kind of like SLOs or SLAs. Like if you are dependent on a service with a 95% SLA, there's no way that you can maintain a 99% SLA. And so production readiness is kind of similar in that sense. On the flip side, if I'm the owner of the service that's now getting called, I may have no idea that this change has happened. And it may potentially affect the criticality of my service without me realizing that. And so it actually begs the question of, should production readiness be a checklist or should it be a programmatically monitored and enforced, continuously monitored and enforced process and checklist so that these things are automatically detected and brought to the attention of each individual service owner as and when those things happen. And so that's kind of the approach that we have been coaching people on, is you should not think about production readiness as a checklist where I'm going through a set of questions, because these things are very hard to catch in a checklist, you know, because it's so manual and things could change at any time. If I start depending on a service and they don't realize that, you know, I'm not going to go back and redo my production readiness requirements review. Rather, if you can codify these requirements as programmatic checks, and even the conditional logic of those checks be programmatic. So, you know, for example, hey, you know, you must have a criticality defined for your service of tier 1, 2, or 3. By the way, you cannot be considered tier 3 if you have more than 10 incoming dependencies in your service. That can be codified pretty easily. And so now if you've codified those things and you're enforcing them programmatically, well, two things happen. One, you don't have this question of like, oh, what if something like just changes and people don't realize it? But B, you can keep continuously monitoring this, and I can go back to the service owner and say, like, hey, Ganesh, your service that was green on production readiness is no longer green because something has changed in its ecosystem. So you need to go back and resolve this concern because you're not meeting those standards anymore. And so this idea of moving away from a checklist to continuously monitor programmatic standards is like a paradigm shift in the way we think about production readiness entirely, for the reasons you described.
You are going in a direction that answers a question I was going to ask. I'll ask it anyway, and then maybe we can find another angle on it. The question was going to be, what type of tooling do you use to capture these checklists? You mentioned a mission lane that you had a big spreadsheet. I assume it was a shared spreadsheet and everybody could go and update cells as either yes or no. And just now you're explaining some of the limitations of that approach. What are some of the types of tooling that either aspirationally might exist or do exist now for managing the process?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a lot of folks still use spreadsheets, and it is the vast majority of things that we see in the wild. This is where I do have to plug Cortex a little bit, which is, like you mentioned earlier, the company that I'm one of the founders of. So we try to solve this problem through a product that we call scorecards. And so scorecards are literally a way of defining a set of standards that can be verified through integration data and are evaluated on some sort of cadence, you know, 4-hour, 12-hour, 24-hour cadence, and use information about the services that are defined in some sort of structured format. So I'll give you a very obvious example. You know, every service before it goes into production needs to have kind of a manifest file that says, this is what the service does. Here's who owns it. This is the team that owns it. Here's the on-call rotation for the service. It's linked to its dashboards and so on and so forth. So it's like a manifest file that describes that service and information about that service. Then we take that and we say, okay, given that, you can now, as a user of Cortex, define the series of checks you want to enforce as production readiness. So, you know, do you have an on-call rotation with multiple escalation levels? Do you have monitoring, alerting? All these kinds of things we're talking about can be enforced through code. And then we constantly evaluate your services against that, and we produce alerts or notifications. We say, you know, hey, Ganesh, like, your service has dropped its score in production readiness from gold to bronze, and therefore you're not meeting our standards anymore. And so folks obviously can use Cortex and scorecards to enforce those kinds of things, or they can build this programmatically into their CI/CD process, or, you know, feed this into a spreadsheet or whatever that might be. At the end of the day, I think the idea is, can you create a system where you're able to define this information about a service in a structured metadata format so that you can then use that data continuously to enforce those standards, whether it's through scorecards in Cortex or whether it's through some sort of CI/CD automation or something like that, where you're kind of verifying facts about that service in a programmatic way. So that's what we see kind of like the aspirations of production readiness is again, yeah, just the automation of these kinds of checks.
Okay, we will link to that product in the show notes. On this topic of dashboards, I wanted to ask about how you right size your checklist for the size and maturity of organization. I'm sure out of the 20 things we've discussed, there could be 20 more. Or maybe have you been involved in a conversation within a company about, is it or is it not appropriate to include a certain item on the checklist?
Yeah. Once your production readiness process / checklist becomes religious in the organization and people have seen the value and really buy into it, then suddenly it becomes very important that you're very thoughtful about new additions to the checklist and the friction that it's going to add, or the amount of time it's going to take to enforce these things, or, you know, things like that are super important. And so it kind of brings me to two things. One is this idea of production readiness being binary. So I think that's actually something that we find to be completely false. Production readiness is a continuous spectrum. You know, it's not just you are very ready or you're not ready at all. You could be kind of ready. You could be very ready or not ready at all. And so it's kind of the spectrum of how ready are you for production. And so that's the first thing we say is take that list of 20, 30 things you have and try to bucket that into like milestones or levels or whatever you want to call them, some sort of like checklists, checkpoints within the checklist of, hey, if you do these five things, you're fine, you're okay. And then aspirationally, and you know, everyone wants to be the best that they can, these additional 10 items are aspirationally good. They mean that you are meeting a new level of production readiness. And by the way, for tier one services, that is the baseline actually. So you can't just be, you know, at the very basic level of production readiness. You actually have to meet this second checkpoint if you're a tier one service. And so can you create this like aspirational set of checkpoints that services can go through over time? And so again, it kind of goes back to that question around, you know, are people trying to circumvent production readiness to get to deadlines or whatever? People would do that maybe if there's like a massive checklist that I'm never going to complete. But if you think about it from a continuous improvement perspective and these checkpoints, it's much easier for me to say, hey, just get to that basic level. Like, it's not that hard. These are the basics. And then you can kind of get better as you go. So that's the first really important thing. I think the second thing is thinking about visibility into production readiness. So, you know, over time, you may learn new things about production readiness. Like, you've found a new failure mode across your organization. Hey, like, we've seen, you know, multiple incidents happen because of this particular class of problem. Feels like something we should put in our production readiness process. Well, now if you have an automated system that's enforcing it, like scorecards, you can go in there, you can codify this new requirement that you've realized is really important, and you figure out, you know, which services are not meeting that requirement and go back to them and say, like, hey, by the way, you're not meeting this requirement, you should go and complete this. But this is where visibility into production readiness is really important, because as a service owner, if I know when things are coming, when I know what things I'm not meeting, I can have visibility into like, oh, there's a new thing that's coming up. This might be on my plate in a month on my sprint. And so it's like, it's not a shocker for me of like, oh my God, there's this mandate coming from SRE and they're breathing that down my neck. And oh my God, I have like 15 tickets I need to complete for my sprint already. And now SRE is telling me to do this other thing. It's like, no, like I see what's coming down the pipe because it's codified. I've been alerted that this thing is coming. And so it's really this idea of like continuous improvement plus visibility equals a more streamlined experience of production readiness. So I don't know if that answers the question, but hopefully that kind of helps how we think about that.
Somewhat. Could you give an example of something that would be on a checklist for a tier one service that might not be on a checklist for a service that's used by internal developers during business hours?
Yeah. For, like you mentioned earlier, capacity planning or load testing might be a great example of that. So, you know, if this is a tier one service, you best believe there's requirements around capacity planning and load testing. And do you know the request throughput that this can handle? And do you know potential spikes that it can handle? You know, what is the baseline amount of traffic it can handle? What are the spikes that it can handle? What is the target SLA that it's adhering to? Does it have an SLO with the proper error budget so that, you know, other services that depend on it can meet their SLAs? So there's a whole bunch of things around like, you know, uptime and quality and performance that an internal tier three service just does not need. You know, if something like that goes down, it's probably not the end of the world. You maybe will alert somebody on it and maybe they have to meet those basic requirements of production readiness. Like if it goes down, there's somebody on the hook to come and bring it back up. But other than that, we're generally fine. That's a great example of something that would only apply to the most critical services versus something internal.
We've done a pretty deep dive into these checklists. When we define what production readiness is as a process, it involves checklists and then some kind of review. Let's get into the review now. Is this review a meeting or how is it conducted?
Yeah. So in most organizations, it's conducted either asynchronously through some sort of like Jira ticket process where I'm submitting my service for production readiness review and submitting a packet with all this information as part of it. And there's some sort of back and forth there. For more complex services, it might be a meeting where I'm going in and, you know, sitting down with the SRE folks and saying, hey, let me walk you through this particular document and how we're thinking about production readiness. And that's kind of an assessment that we're doing together. In some cases, it's a combination of both where, you know, SRE might come back to you and say like, hey, we need a meeting. And so it's generally this kind of like asynchronous manual process, either through ticketing or through some sort of meeting. if you're using kind of like a scorecarding solution or an automated system, then it's very much just like, it could be an automated gate in your deployment pipeline, which is like, I don't even have to involve anybody. My service has been evaluated against this. And before I hit the deploy button, it's just going to check, are you good? Are you green? Yep. All right. Well, you can deploy and there's no human involved in the process anymore other than actually codifying those standards and me following those standards. And so I think that's where like the process can be different based on where you are in that maturity of production readiness.
Can you think of a question that you've gotten during a review and something you didn't expect? And what did you learn from that?
You know, one of the most surprising questions I had, and this was from like a really seasoned SRE engineer, was about dashboards. You know, one of the requirements on our production readiness process was, do you have a centralized dashboard for the service that can be, you know, used for monitoring the service? And you're like, yeah, cool. I, you know, slap a bunch of widgets together. You know, you think you have your key metrics on there. And, you know, the first thing we get hit with is like, okay, cool. Like you, this is fine. Like it's good enough. But have you thought about, is this easy for you to consume when something's going wrong? Like, yes, you have visibility into it. You can probably drill into it, but are you actually going to be able to use this dashboard to quickly triage what a potential root cause is? And how would you think about designing this dashboard in a way that's easy to consume? And that, it was such a mind-blowing moment for me because it's one of those like very qualitative things about, you know, operational excellence. But like, is this dashboard actually usable? Does it have useful information? And you hear this kind of stuff all the time. I know, you know, in most cases, our day-to-day operations as software engineers is not, you know, like flying a plane, but you hear this about, you know, design and instruments for planes where it's like, hey, displaying information in the right way is so important because you need to be able to consume information very rapidly. And the layout and the way information is displayed is so important to this. And there's no reason why we shouldn't kind of take that same lens to our own dashboards that we're building. And so, I don't know, that was so fascinating to me. That's like, yeah, I absolutely should be thinking about my own dashboards from that lens of, you know, information density, but consumability when things are hitting the fan and sites down and I'm trying to triage this thing. Can I very quickly answer the questions that I need and get to the next question, the best next step, with the information visualization that's provided to me? So that was absolutely fascinating.
That question makes me think about how the production readiness process is forcing the service designers or the service owners to build products for which the customer is the SRE group. If you simply boil it down to a question of, do you have dashboards? You say, yes, we have dashboards. Is that really the end of the discussion? Or do you need to go through a product acceptance with your users who are SRE, where they authenticate into the dashboards, they try them, and then they give you feedback about what they like or don't like, or it's pretty good, but could you add this metric? Isn't it more of a product development process than a yes, no?
It's a great point. And I think generally, yes. However, when we think about how complex modern engineering organizations are, I think it's difficult to expect that a typical application developer has the same level of understanding around operational practices as an SRE does. I mean, SRE has spent their career specializing in this thing. And so, yes, you could have a process that has, you know, product acceptance, things like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just going to create so much friction. And I think that's where we're seeing this kind of going back to that earlier concept around like platform and SRE and how they're working together. Really mature organizations get to a point where if I'm using the tools provided to me by the platform team that is going to bootstrap me a repository and generate the boilerplate code and instrument the service with the right agent and provision the infrastructure, I'm also going to get my dashboards for free, my runbook and pipelines for free. Like, I shouldn't have to think about this. I'm going to leave that to the experts. I'm going to follow the golden paths and I'm going to get out of the box the things that the experts have determined to be, hey, this is what we know is state of the art, that you don't even have to think about it. We don't expect you to learn this. We're going to give you the best experience possible. And therefore, my job is easier. Your job is easier. That's a great developer experience. So I think that's what we've realized is with all the specialization in software engineering, we're just too far, you know, away from expecting application developers to have that level of expertise that an SRE or security person would.
Anish, we're getting close to end of time. We've hit on all the main points that I've outlined. Are there any other important issues around production readiness we haven't covered?
I think the number one thing that I would want to cover outside of that is just visibility. And I know we've briefly touched on visibility, but the reason I think it's so interesting to talk about visibility is production readiness is one of those things that tends to be looked at kind of the front lines of your engineering organization, right? It's your SRE team, that's your developers, and they're the ones kind of looking at production readiness. But you know, there's no reason that engineering leadership should not be looking at the outcomes of production readiness, right? If we believe in the assumption that production readiness is a continuous process, you know, it is something that you can continuously improve over time, then engineering leadership should have visibility into, hey, where are we generally production readiness? You know, are we meeting our aspirations? Are we at the very bare bones of production readiness? Where are the teams that are doing the best, doing the worst on production readiness? And so visibility of production readiness up and down the chain is extremely important, because if, for example, I see that, you know, most teams are just not doing three of the requirements for some reason, and that's never surfaced to me as a CTO, how am I going to know that there's a gap in that particular area? You know, if, especially if it's an aspirational requirement. But if I see that, I can say, hey, I'm starting to see this risk bubble up, and maybe it's because we're just not giving our teams the tooling to solve that problem. And so we can't hold them to that expectation. Maybe I need to go and invest in, you know, a streamlined low testing capacity testing platform so that we can meet those requirements, because we're making it way too hard for developers. And so driving that visibility up the chain and even including production readiness thresholds and standards in like all hands, hey, 80% of our teams are meeting, you know, the highest level of production readiness. By the way, that drove down our MTTR on these teams by 30%. Look at the big wins. You know, we should, you know, aspire to get the remaining 20% up. That is going to drive this culture of excellence. And it makes your SRE team's job a lot easier, because SREs are tasked with a monumental job of trying to get people to care about these things and enforce these standards. But if your leadership is looking at this stuff too and driving that visibility, it completely changes the conversation. And now it's a thing that the entire organization is kind of rallying behind. And I'm able to now use that to assess risk in a way that I wasn't able to before. So that's the last thing I wanted to mention is like, hey, make this something your leaders care about too, not just your SREs, not just your developers. It's for everyone.
Ganesh, is there anywhere on the internet you'd like to point people?
Yeah, you can connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter. I talk a lot about this stuff. It's something near and dear to my heart as a developer. Like everyone else, I hate getting paged in the middle of the night. That was my worst nightmare. And so if production readiness and things like this are one way of reducing that pain, then it's something that I really care about. So yeah, definitely follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn. And I love to post about this kind of stuff.
Ganesh, I'm going to wrap up here. Thank you very much for speaking to Software Engineering Radio about production readiness.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Robert Blumen for Software Engineering Radio.
Thanks for listening to SE Radio, an educational program brought to you by IEEE Software Magazine. For more about the podcast, including other episodes, visit our website at se-radio.net. To provide feedback, you can comment on each episode on the website or reach us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or through our Slack channel at seradio.slack.com. You can also email us at team@se-radio.net. This and all other episodes of SE Radio is licensed under Creative Commons License 2.5. Thanks for listening.